Right, it is time for our monthly chat about pets, and today we're contemplating the question of how they became pets in the first place. What is actually the history of man's interaction with animals in a domesticated setting? And how does that past influence the way we manage those relationships in the present? It's always a delight to have animal behaviorist John Fall on the line with us, and I'm sure he's going to give us fascinating insight into this history. John, great to have you back on the show. Welcome.
Thank you, Pippa. Always great chatting with you.
So where does it all begin, John? How far back in history did we first domesticate animals? Do we even know?
There are many postulations as to what that might have been and when it might have been. But I can assure you something. One thing I'm certain of was man did little domesticating, because man at his state at the time had just come out of an ice age and had left the cave and was thoroughly uncertain of who he was, where he was, where he was going, and most importantly, where was his next meal coming from and how would he avoid becoming that? Mm-hmm. So this idea of man being the great domesticator is palpable nonsense, Pippa. Aliamimetic, see and repeat. We are the jolly-come-latelys of those that rocked up on this planet. And what we did in everything we do in physics, and if you look at any of the designs we have, they're all replications. I was going to say plagiarization, but I'll be kind and say replications. Mm-hmm. Of what has already occurred in nature. So when we look at the idea of domestication, domestication isn't any sort of procedure per se. It means domicile in Latin. It means you're in residence. It says nothing about a contract sign that I will pull your slate or that I will herd your cattle. There was very little of that written into it. But when we go back into me personally, when I look at it, how the relationship occurred and why most probably it would have, especially for the wolf would have been, the wolf, Pippa, as you're well aware, is possibly the most successful animal on this planet. Not the most populous, but definitely the most successful. Mm-hmm. And certainly the most intelligent, emotionally intelligent, physically intelligent, and environmentally intelligent. They top the tree always. And then you'd ask yourself, why would an animal who was so near perfection in its creation and its ability to master its environment, why and what need would it have had to have had any interface with human beings? Human beings, they had a bad sense of smell, their hearing wasn't great, their eyesight wasn't great, they didn't run really quickly, they didn't have big sharp teeth. Where was the symbiotic relationship going to be born out? Because the symbiotic relationship is, I scratch your back and you scratch mine. Yeah. Well, what was the human going to do apart from physically scratch the wolf's back? Nothing. So we look at him, I said to myself that it was through the allomimetic law that there were humans, enlightened, who looked outside of their present state and went and wandered and decided to look at the natural world for a solution. And one of those witnessed the wolf pack in action and was completely blown away by it. He watched the ordered system. He watched the conflict avoidance system. He watched how they rear their young. He watched their leaders and very quickly recognized that they were well worth following. And that's why the rest of them followed. So as he began to analyze this behavior, he thought, let's make an overlap for humankind. Whatever humankind were and what they got up to before then, this event very definitely changed them. Human beings started to adapt this into their way of living, and it allowed them to settle down. But then the question is, where did man get his hands on that wolf? If the wolf would not come to him out of need, how did man get him? Man, being a curious entity himself, wanted one of these wolves, and the easiest way to get one of them was to kill the she-wolf and to remove her puppies from the den and to take them to the cave or to the kraal and then decide that we would domesticate them and that they would become members of our group and that they could share these great prowess with us, this ability to smell prey from afar, the speed of foot, all of these things were all going to be transferred. And from the puppies that they gathered, there is an alpha male, there is a labor distributive law, Pippa, that governs a pack of wolves, much as it does human beings today. And in that, you would have had an alpha and all the way right down through the rank. And everybody up to the runt would have shown aggression when they were handled. And man had one criterion. He must not show aggression toward me. It's okay for him to show aggression toward other things, but not me. So sadly, those that did were dispatched. And the runt, when it came to its turn, having witnessed what happened to its littermates, dutifully rolled over on its back and urinated on itself in a submissive postulation. And man smiled and said, yes, we can work with this. And from this, he had the first in that relationship. And then Mrs. Smith and Mrs. Jones and Mrs. O'Brien and Mrs. Fitzgibbons, they all copied. And then we began to interbreed our runts, which would never become full mature wolves. We were very, very careful about this. The runt in a litter of puppies is there as a sounder. Any tension in the group, he can dissipate it, or somebody can ritually show aggression toward him and relieve the tension in the group. So he's very malleable as a character. So when we bred with those, we ended up with what we call today's domestic dog. But the domestic, as we said, is very questionable, and dog is even more questionable because I call it the wolf in dog's clothing, because that's what it is. People have given it a name, and little does it understand it, but because of what it is being given, it's never been given the right to be what it is, a fully fledged member of a hunting pack in this day and age. Today, he rests inside in the living room, he's on the couch, and he has well earned it. And if anybody ever questions why there are programs like this about wolves today and other animals, it's because the wolf has played such a huge role. We would never have been successful hunters, Pippa. We would never have picked up the trail. We would never have safely kept our cattle and our sheep and our goats without the wolves that we had brought into our environment, and nearly said domesticated, brought into our environment, and learned very quickly that they would make us aware of other predators that would try and take these livestock. So when we look at the level of interface, there has been no level of interface to match this among all the other animals that we have learned to live with and learned to utilize. But thankfully today what we're looking at is we're looking at a resurgence of the idea of this wolf. And no longer this dog that it's okay to hit, it's okay to shout at, it's okay to neglect. When you understand that it is something greater than that dog, and it is indeed a wolf, and it's part of this lifelong relationship, you'll see it differently, and you will treat it differently. And I've got a little saying, Pippa, that goes, if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, I will not treat it like a budgie. If it walks like a duck, a wolf, and it howls and barks like a wolf, then I'm not treating it like a dog. So when we look at the domestication and the payoff that we've gotten from this domestication, I ask myself a very simple question. When confronted with the reality of the needs of animals, humans have needs, but animals have needs as well. We very quickly forget about the contribution that the animals have made. We'll hand out laudits and applaudits to people centuries dead, and we have yet to come to terms with the idea of officially recognizing, apart from the Saint Bernard, who perfected an old trick of finding humans because humans were easy to find. And it was from that and only that that the dog got its recognition. So did man domesticate the wolf? Definitely not. Did the wolf domesticate man? Very certainly, Pippa. Absolutely certain. Because when you look at the family structure, mom, dad, kids, granny, grandpa, uncle, auntie, cousins, there's only other one group that replicate that, and that's the wolf. No other animal has the complexity, the living complexity, the rule system, the labor distributive law that is all designed and governed toward the success of one thing, their offspring. And that seems to be the one that we don't seem to have picked up upon, which is the value of offspring, that they are the most valuable things ever created. They are more than any past, present, and they are indeed the future. And wolves understand that, and other animals understand that. And the more you listen to radio broadcasts and news broadcasts, you begin to seriously doubt, does it ever exist or will it ever exist with humans?
John Fall, animal behaviorist. It is always fascinating listening to your insights into the animal structures and how they overlap when they come into our ambit as humans. Thank you so much for that absolutely fascinating insight into the development of the so-called domestication of the dog. I'm going to look at it very differently going forward.